Hello, everyone, and welcome to our podcast on Abraham, From the Call to the Promise. Our last podcast concluded with God's rejection of all humankind at Babel, confusing their language to prevent completion of the city and its temple tower. It follows from the model of the flood, where humankind rebelled, intermarrying with angels, with God shortening their lives in response to their attempt to lengthen their lives. At Babel, humankind in unity rebelled, refusing to scatter and fill the earth. In response, God broke their unity and scattered them across the earth. It brings the question, how will God reestablish unity and eliminate barriers of language? In that podcast, we showed its fulfillment at Pentecost. The ancient reader of Genesis, however, lacks this knowledge. The author of Genesis proceeds to answer this question by next presenting the family history of Shem, the appointed line. As in the prior age, God will raise up a redeemer from among men to restore rejected humankind, and that redeemer would come through Shem in reward for his righteous act of covering his father. His family history consists of 9 generations to Terah, closing with the announced birth of his 3 sons. Shem's family history closely parallels Adam's family history in Genesis 5 that also tracks the Redeemer's line. The 5th generation from both Seth and Shem marks the rebellion in each age. The 5th from Seth was Jared, whose name means descent, marking the descent of fallen angels that intermarried women. The 5th from Shem was Peleg, whose name means divided, marking when the rebellion at Babel occurred, with God dividing the peoples. Each age is marked by a rebellion at the middle point of the family histories, with 4 generations preceding the rebellion and 4 following, ending in judgment. Adam's family history, however, lists 10 generations, ending with Noah and the announced birth of his 3 sons. A difference of 1 generation results from inclusion of Seth's father Adam in the 1st family history, with the 2nd excluding the father Noah. This small difference reflects back to Abel's murder and subsequent rejection of Cain, leaving Adam without a redemptive line. Adam's inclusion assures the reader that despite the death of the redemptive line of Abel, he embraced God's call to be fruitful and increase by having another son in his image and likeness, Seth. With destruction of Abel's redemptive line, the redemptive line is extended to Seth. It establishes a link to Noah's family history that similarly extended the redemptive call to Japheth. Each family history shows strong parallels. It is by design, showing 9 generations from the appointed son, Seth or Shem, to the one called to the role of redeemer. It highlights an important point. Noah was called as redeemer of the prior age. In the new era, it was Terah, not Abraham, that was called. While important to Abraham's story, it proves essential to the story of Abraham's seed, Israel. It was Terah that was called to leave Ur, taking his family with him. Terah conducted an exodus from Ur, but stopped and settled in Haran, failing to complete the exodus and enter the land. The short insertion at the end of Terah's family history connects Terah's family history to Abram, to whom the narrative next turns. With the failure of the 1st generation to complete the Exodus, the call was extended to the 2nd generation, Abram, who obediently entered the land. It foreshadows Israel's exodus from Egypt under Moses, in which the 1st generation failed to complete their exodus and enter the land, with the call then extended to the 2nd generation to enter the land. And of course, both foreshadow Israel's exodus from the nations, led by the greater than Moses, Jesus Christ, in which the 1st generation failed their call to enter God's heavenly land, with the call then extended to the 2nd generation, those born again, to enter what Hebrews 11 calls God's heavenly country, that Matthew calls the kingdom of heaven. One is immediately struck by the advanced testimony of these early biblical narratives. Before passing on to the story of Abram, we should point out another interesting parallel. Adam had three sons, one called his redemptive partner but killed, Abel, one passed over as redemptive partner, Cain, and one to whom the call to serve as redemptive partner was extended, Seth. Noah had three sons, one called his redemptive partner, Shem, one passed over as redemptive partner, Canaan, and one to whom the call was extended, Japheth. And Terah also had three sons, one called his redemptive partner, Abram, one passed over as redemptive partner, Nahor, and one who died, Haran, leaving his son Lot, to whom the call was extended, with Lot accompanying Abram to the land. It is again by design, patterned to illumine God's redemptive plan. This recurrent pattern of three sons suggests a closer look. Our last podcast considered the oddity that nothing was said of Ham with the curse placed upon Canaan. Unexpectedly, Isaiah 19 breaks the silence, noting that some of Ham's descendants would one day become priests in the house of God. Consider the parallel with Abram, Nahor, and Haran. As nothing was said of Ham, here in Genesis 11, nothing is said of Nahor. His decision to remain in Ur, however, suggests that he was redemptively passed over, seeming to exclude his descendants from a redemptive call. Mention of his wife Milcah, however, intends to connect to Abram's search for Isaac's bride, yet it also affirms a redemptive role would be extended to some of Nahor's descendants through Isaac's marriage to Rebekah, Milcah's granddaughter. The parallel with Ham reveals God's incredible grace. Poor choices of a parent do not bind God's hands with their descendants. A redemptive role is still possible. Finally, in contrast to Milcah, Terah's family history reveals that Abram's wife Sarah was barren, leaving her childless. Her barrenness becomes the central issue that must be resolved. All 18 of Abram's forebears were fruitful, birthing the promised son through whom the Redeemer would come, and also fruitful in having other sons and daughters. Any ancient reader would implicitly assume Abram would also be fruitful, given his call as father of the Redeemer. Yet Abram has neither promised son nor other sons and daughters. This crisis becomes the thread that binds the entire narrative together. Abram's land grant serves no purpose without descendants to dwell there. Shem's genealogy identifies Terah as Redeemer. He was told to leave Ur and go to a new land he did not know. Why must he leave the land and the people he knew? Like Noah's journey on the ark to save his family, Terah must take his family, leave the land he knew behind, and enter a new world. In doing so, he would save his family judgment of rejection on the other peoples. Again, events of the New Age parallel those of the prior age. With Terah's decision to remain in Haran, the call was extended to Abram. He was instructed to go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. In return, God makes a sevenfold promise marked by blessing. First, to make Abram into a great nation. Second, to bless him. Third, to make his name great. Fourth, to make him a blessing. Fifth, to bless those who bless him. Sixth, to curse those who curse or disdain him. And seventh, that all the nations of the earth would be blessed through him. This far-reaching promise sets Abram apart from his 18 forebears, who were also promised to father the Redeemer. It makes Abram quite special, worthy of careful study. What does this promise mean? If we return to the flood story, Noah, as Redeemer, removed the curse of unfruitfulness on the ground, giving man rest from his fruitless labor, and cleansing the earth by flood water of its blood violence. We should expect, then, that Abram would remove the curse of division of the people into nations by raising up a humble but great nation that would reprove proud Babylon that presumed greatness. The first and seventh clauses of the promise certainly suggest it. But to fully grasp how, one must appreciate that blessing, for the ancients, was a cipher for life. To bless is to bring forth life, much as to curse brings death. Thus, the one great nation comprised of Abram's descendants will play a redemptive role in reuniting the nations, bringing salvation to those who have been rejected and separated from God. It is what makes this one nation great. How this will be accomplished is left unexplained, but we can expect that Abram's story will reveal it. Just as God raised up one man, Abram, to redeem the nations, his descendants will be raised up as one nation to restore unity of divided nations. This is the heart of the first and the seventh clauses. The second, third, and fourth clauses are a bit more mysterious. For the ancients, blessing was highly sought after, cursing strongly abhorred. That Abram would be blessed implies that he would be given abundant life. It affirms that Abram will be fruitful as both father of the Redeemer and fruitful in having many sons and daughters. How it will be fulfilled is not revealed until Genesis 15, when Abram is promised both a son and descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. For Abram, it is an incredible blessing. In regard to making Abram's name great, this promised blessing is so shocking that it alone should make Abram's name great. Yet more so, Abram's name will be great through the work of his greater, Jesus Christ, God's chosen Redeemer, who would accomplish what Abram could only foreshadow and prototype. The promise of a great name was also made to David, another prototype of Christ. Other than that, only God's name is called great. It puts Abram in an elite league. Abram would also be a blessing, again implying life-bringing through his redemptive role, but more so through his descendants who would also partner with God in redemption of the nations. In another shocking twist, Genesis 17 foreshadows that Abram's innumerable descendants would include his household, something many would find scandalous. The fifth and sixth clauses have been highly misunderstood, often weaponized within the pastorate. Those who bless Abram will be blessed. Those who disdain him will be cursed. Ironically, Abram's redemptive role divides the peoples of the earth. The unifier divides. Those blessing him and supporting his redemptive activities are blessed with life. Those who disdain, hinder, or oppose his redemptive activities are unredeemed, cursed with eternal death. What is meant by blessing Abram is unclear, but a clue may be found in the unique blessing given Japheth. As Japheth was blessed in teaming with Shem in a righteous act, those who redemptively team with Abram will be blessed with life. It foreshadows the salvation of the nations, with the gospel extended to the Gentiles by believing Jews. One now begins to fully appreciate the far-reaching implications of Noah's prophecy. The sevenfold promise, then, anticipates revelation later given to Abraham, and in fact connects to the promise of land in Genesis 15, with innumerable descendants in Genesis 17. The sevenfold promise is the basis for the later revelations of land and people. One now also sees how important this precedent-setting promise is. Contained within it is God's redemptive plan in seed form. In light of that, it is shocking how often commentators miss its importance, speaking only about the promise of land and descendants without realizing these promises are subordinate to this seven-pronged promise. Worse, with the Jewish return to Palestine, the promise of land has blotted out both the promise of descendants and the sevenfold promise on which both were based, leaving the promise of land theologically unmoored from God's redemptive purposes. Proponents believing that the land of Palestine belongs to returning Jews fail to see that their return has not brought innumerable descendants, nor has it redeemed and reunited the nations. These critical promises have faded out of view. With the promise in hand, Abram departed Haran with his wife and nephew Lot, leaving behind his father Terah. The story is symmetrically arranged so that Abram has 75 years with his father, 25 years without father or son, and 75 years with his son. Accompanying him were his possessions, including the people they had acquired at Haran, servants he purchased. This small insertion connects to Genesis 17, explaining peculiar instructions the Lord gave Abram. On arrival in Canaan, Abram traveled to Shechem, where the Lord appeared to him, saying, "To your descendants I will give this land." The promise of land was thus extended to his descendants in recognition of his obedience in reaching the land. In thankfulness, Abram built an altar for sacrifice and worship, paralleling Noah, who shortly after arriving in the New World also built an altar for sacrifice and worship. He then moved and encamped between Bethel and Ai, where he built another altar, calling upon the name of the Lord in worship. It was at Shechem the author reveals that at that time the Canaanites were in the land. It connects to Israel's accession of land after Exodus from Egypt, while also connecting to Genesis 15, where Abram is promised the land. He would not immediately possess it, however, as the Canaanites possessed it upon Abram's arrival. Abram's journeys continued to take him from the northern border of the land to its southern border, symbolically taking possession of it. His arrival in the Negev, translated the dry land, sets the stage for his next adventure that would force his exit from the land. In conclusion, some surprising points can be ascertained, despite that we are still quite early in Abram's story. First, it is noteworthy that the story of Abraham begins with mention of Terah's genealogical history. These family histories neatly divide Genesis into 11 sections. Each is not a boring, unimportant list of descendants to be quickly passed over in search of the story. The family histories provide the frame for the stories that fall between, providing valuable background information, not simply for the stories that follow, but for each redemptive era, warranting careful study. A salient example is found in the names of the persons found at the midpoint of the two lists we studied, with each signaling a rebellion against God. The author informs us that rebellion occurs at the midpoint of the age, and judgment follows at the end of the age. The author reminds us that grace delays God's judgment, allowing time for repentance. Though judgment is delayed, it is still assured. A parallel can be found in the Jewish rebellion against Christ that resulted in his crucifixion. The Bible envisions Christ's death as the midpoint of God's redemptive plan. What occurred before is a foreshadowing. What occurs after leads ultimately to judgment at the end of the ages, when God's redemptive plan is completed. Second, the pattern where the firstborn is passed over for the secondborn continues and is further developed in Abram, the second generation, entering the land after the first generation, Terah, failed to complete his exodus. It foreshadows failure of the first generation of Abraham's descendants, Israel, after their exodus from Egypt. And Israel's exodus history under Moses foreshadows her failure to enter the land following the greater than Moses' exodus from the kingdoms of our world into the kingdom of heaven. This truth applies not only corporately to the body of Christ, it applies to every believer, everyone offered salvation. Being born again requires death of the old nature, the carnal self that by nature is first birthed. It is opposed to Christ. Less noted is when the pattern of the secondborn or second generation displaces the first. The first two family histories show that the secondborn displaces the firstborn only at the start of each new era. It foreshadows Christ as a new man, father of a new humanity that partners with him in redemption. Yet that partnership is made with those who are by nature firstborn and carnal. It is foreshadowed in these family histories, in which every son after the first is a firstborn. God chooses to partner with those who are firstborn, blessing them and making them fruitful. What the family histories do not tell us, however, is that through Christ, the firstborn that he calls must die to self and be born again, joining the secondborn after the Spirit. Third, in Abraham, we begin to see the implications of the fulfillment of Noah's prophecy of his three sons. Abram, descendant of Shem, is called to a redemptive role and must take possession of the land. Canaan's descendants are in the land promised Abram and must be subdued. The role of Japheth's descendants is not yet manifest, but promise that from Abraham will come one great nation that blesses the 70 nations lays the foundation. Despite numerous parallels to the story of Noah, a key difference is found in the sevenfold promise to Abram. Its first and final clauses signal that, unlike Noah, Abram's family will not be the only ones saved. Abram's redemptive call will extend to Japheth's descendants in the nations. It is only a question of how. Answering that question is part of the marvel contained in the story of Abraham. Fourth, the promise is marked by blessing, with Abraham said to be blessed, or a blessing to others, a total of 5 times. It is a fitting description for the church. Blessed with salvation, to be a salvation blessing to the nations. God promises to raise up one nation to bless the 70 nations by bringing redemption to the 70 nations, reuniting them with membership in the one great nation, Israel. The first and seventh clauses confirm that Israel displaces the nations. In our prior podcast on Babel, we revealed the way God fulfills this promise. Those from the nations accepting our offer of salvation are extended citizenship in Israel resurrected, the community of those born again, the resurrected. The church is Israel resurrected. We are already resurrected in inauguration, awaiting bodily resurrection and consummation at the end of the age. Finally, Genesis 2 forces us to confront our free will. The family histories force us to confront God's sovereign election. It was by His will that each age opens with God passing over the firstborn for the secondborn. It is not the result of good or bad on the part of either actor. It is God's choice. It is evident in Terah and Abram. Each was called by God as redemptive partner. The difference is obedience. Election is by God's will and comes first, but free will still works hand in hand with it. The same pattern of obedience is found in Enoch and Noah, emphasizing obedience for realization of God's promises to his people. Abraham's obedience can be contrasted with consistent disobedience of Abraham's descendants that ended in failure of Israel's redemptive call. Both Terah and Israel were called by God, but disobedience reveals their place outside the community of the elect. It is not enough to be called. Obedience is a fruit intended to identify the chosen, the elect. And that makes Abraham a model for all believers, a man of faith, supremely obedient, accepting God's call to leave his homeland and family, living as a foreigner in our world, in search of a heavenly country and heavenly city, the new Jerusalem, whose builder is God, Hebrews 11 and 12. What a contrast with those who seek an earthly country and earthly city, Babylon, whose builders were mere men. We hope you found our podcast on Abraham from the Call to the Promise insightful. For more information on this and other biblical themes, visit us at The Biblical Road Less Traveled at Substack or join us on Medium.com. We're also at RedemptiveBibleStudies.com. I'm Roger McCurdy. Until our next podcast, God bless and thanks for joining.